All right, this remote hearing is taking place pursuant to Rule 10.01, which you may view on our committee page. Today our theme is, today is Criminal Sexual Conduct Oversight and Accountability Day, where we will look at right-sizing our criminal sex statutes. The first thing on the agenda will be presentation from Predatory Offender Working Group presentation, and I will turn it over to Representative Kelly Moeller and Representative Marion O'Neill.
Mr. Chair,
thank you all. A little bit rusty. first I have to actually approve the minutes, but thank you all for jumping in there and helping me out today. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes from February 24th?
We should take the roll call first. We need to establish a quorum.
Thank you all. take the roll, please.
Chair Mariani, excused. Vice Chair Frazier?
Present.
Representative Johnson?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Grossel?
Present.
Representative Hollins?
Present.
Representative Hewitt?
Present.
Representative Cleavorn?
Present.
Representative Long?
Present.
Representative Lucero?
Excited for Friday.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller, present.
Representative Novotny?
I'm here on a Friday.
Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang?
Vang, present.
Representative Shung?
Shung, present.
And that concludes roll call.
Thank you, members. Since we have a quorum, could I please get someone to a motion to approve the minutes from February 24th?
Chair Frazier, I would like to move those minutes.
Thank you, Representative Poston, for moving those minutes for February 24th. Representative Johnson, is a vote split okay?
That would be fine.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motions have been moved and approved. First measure on the agenda is a Predatory Offender Working Group presentation, and I will turn it over to Representative Moeller and Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the committee for having us today to talk about this. So over the last couple of years, we've talked in this committee at the legislature too about updating our criminal sexual conduct laws. We created a working group to take a comprehensive look at our CSC laws and make a number of recommendations. And as you probably know, the group last year made those recommendations, and we implemented a majority of those, except for a couple of things that were still left outstanding. The report that the CSC Working Group issued last year is included in your packets today. So one of the things that remains outstanding, it was mentioned on page 5 of the CSC report, and it goes into a little more detail, but I'll just start with this quote. Members consistently express concerns about the predatory offender registration, POR, requirements for those convicted of CSC crimes, close quote. Looking at the POR laws wasn't something that this working group was tasked to do, but it was something that was really important to the CSC working group, and they mentioned it throughout their report. So ultimately, the CSC working group led to the creation of the POR working group that we enacted last year. And the POR working group is the first time that we've comprehensively studied the sex offender registry to determine whether it is effective and serving the public as intended. The POR report is in your packet, and you'll hear today from the three co-chairs about the recommendations by the group. And before they testify, I'd just like to note that the registry was established after the abduction of Jacob Wetterling. I believe it was established in 1991, and it's been expanded over time. There are currently over 18,000 registrants. During the working group process that I participated in, I learned that Minnesota requires children as young as 10 to register. It is one of the most expansive frameworks for juvenile registrants in the nation. I also learned that Minnesota requires registration both for youth and adults, not just for convictions of crimes, but also for crimes arising out of the same set of circumstances. Minnesota appears to be the only state requiring an individual to be registered if they are not convicted of an enumerated crime, but one arising out of the same set of circumstances. And we also learned that we lack data on the effectiveness of the registry. We don't have any data regarding how useful a tool it is and how many cases it helps to solve. You know, it was meant to help solve those stranger sexual assault cases, but we do know that most sexual assaults have known perpetrators. It was also started at a time when our science wasn't as good as it is now. For example, the DNA evidence and the rape kits that we have that can help solve crimes. That said, nobody on the group wanted to eliminate the registry. Everyone understands it serves a very important purpose. But there was agreement that we needed more data on its effectiveness, and I am working on a bill with Representative O'Neill to address this issue. A number of other reforms were recommended, which you'll hear about today. I want to thank the DOC and the BCA for co-facilitating the POR working group, to all the members of the group and the three co-chairs. I was glad to serve on this committee with Representative O'Neill, who will also make some introductory remarks.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to Representative Mueller, and we did serve on this, as did Senator Ingebrigtsen. I was a part of, I think, every single meeting except for maybe one, and we had three subgroups that met. It was a very robust conversation. There was very little agreement, unanimous agreement. So that is kind of where Representative Mueller and I are a little bit stuck, because we know that to move something forward, you really have to come to agreement. And while there was incredible in-depth conversation and we raised many concerns, we went in-depth into many issues with the POR. We didn't come to consensus on a lot. And so you're going to hear some of these various concerns and issues from all sides, because you've got those that obviously are on the POR, and then you have people that are protected by the use of the POR. So law enforcement, those in the BCA, and the victims' rights groups. So there was concern across the board making changes, because obviously we don't want to get it wrong. This is an incredibly important tool for law enforcement. Unfortunately, we don't know how often it's used and how often it's used to solve crime. So one of the recommendations that Representative Mueller and I may move forward is simply asking for a better database or better information, because obviously, if we're going to change something, we absolutely need to know the truth, the data, and the facts, because we are, it's absolutely essential, right? If we're going to do that at the legislature, we need to know what the truth is. So we had a lot of conversation. We had a lot of anecdotal information. We had some national information, but as you know, here in Minnesota, sometimes we're a little bit outside of the norm, good and bad. So we really needed Minnesota data, Minnesota statistics, which just weren't readily available. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to the three chairs, the three co-chairs of this, and they can kind of go through their individual subgroups that they led and the information that we discussed. And you can kind of digest it for yourself and see what you think, because it is a very big topic. And with that, thank you, Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. I've got three people listed here, Stacey Bettison, Angela Keys, and Sheriff Troy Heck. Should we start with Ms. Bettison?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stacey Bettison, and I'm an attorney in private practice. I was one of the three co-chairs on this working group. And I will take a few minutes to give you an overview of what we did. First of all, I want to thank Representative Mueller and Representative O'Neill for their participation in this group. And this was a lot of work. It is very complex. There was robust discussion. And I would say that we never had unanimous agreement, never. But we got close on a lot of issues, and so I would clarify or add on to Representative O'Neill's comment that while we didn't have a full agreement, we had a large majority of agreement on most of the issues, And we will let you know. And the report sets out very clearly where there wasn't a large majority, but on many of the proposed legislative reforms, there was a large majority of support. So I would just add that. Representative Mueller gave a great overview of the CSC working group and how the registry came to be of concern as we were expanding criminal liability in the work of the CSC working group. There was this concern that at the same time we were there was going to be impact to the registry, which Representative Mueller mentioned is at around 18,000 people on any given day. And as a sidebar, looking back to why the registry was enacted in the first place, as Representative Mueller mentioned, it was during that time that the Wetterling family was so desperately searching for Jacob when he was abducted. They were operating with a dearth of information. And as Patty has said publicly, time was of the essence, and they needed to quickly identify and clear suspects. But they had no way to do that in one database. They had to go jurisdiction by jurisdiction. And so law enforcement was hampered that way. And so they created the registry, which ironically, Danny Heinrich, the man who later confessed to abducting and killing Jacob, would not have been on the registry because he had never been charged or convicted of a sex crime. So turning back to the CSC working group and how we were starting to look at the POR at that point, you know, we can ask this question, well, why do we care about an increasingly large registry? After all, these people were either charged or they committed a crime. Shouldn't they be tracked? Shouldn't we give law enforcement every tool it needs to solve crimes? And don't we want to protect the public? And I would say the answer to those questions are yes. Yes, we want to protect the public. We want law enforcement to have effective tools to solve crimes quickly. And mostly, we want fewer victims. We actually want no victims. So this question kept coming up. How does the registry get us those things? How does it increase public safety? Is it an effective tool? How does law enforcement use it to actually solve crimes? And is it reducing the number of victims of sex crimes? In essence, is it working as it was intended? So we asked in the CSC working group for a POR working group, and you, the legislature, gave us that, and thank you. We had an incredibly committed and diverse group of people, and we worked our tails off from September to December of last year to make the recommendations that are in this report. This is very complex, and I will say today it requires further study. We only had 4 months, and we need more time, and we ask for that in the report. We ask for data. We ask for to understand more about how many cases with an unknown assailant are solved every year because of the registry, with information unique to the registry, with information that we can't get anywhere else but the registry. And at a cost of more than $1 million per year to administer, how is it helping solve crimes where the assailant is unknown? We make a recommendation regarding juveniles on the registry, and Angela will talk about that in a little bit more depth. But what we know is that juveniles are different than us adults. Their brains are different, and there is grave concern that by having children as young as 10 on the registry, who they themselves may be a victim of a sex crime, that we're not doing right by children. And the report that you have is replete with information supporting recommendations regarding juveniles. And then Sheriff Heck will talk about the false imprisonment and requiring an actual conviction for false imprisonment. Representative Mueller mentioned that Minnesota is the only state that requires a registrant or requires someone accused or charged of a crime to register if it arose under the same set of circumstances as the crime for which they were convicted. And so we're very unique that way, and that is creating a large net of pulling a lot of people in there that were never even convicted of a registrable offense. We make a recommendation that registrants be given an opportunity to petition for relief from their registration obligations upon a showing that they have been law-abiding, that they pose little risk to the public to reoffend, and that by offering them relief from their registry obligations, we help them to be to continue to contribute and be strong members of our community. And that is where the recidivism rates go down. Many states have a mechanism for a registrant to petition to come off the registry. We do not, and I encourage the legislature to give that serious thought and analysis. And that requires more study, frankly, as well. The registry, I will say, in its current iteration, is based on one important assumption, that people who are convicted of a sex crime are significantly more likely than not to commit another sex crime. And courts have even adopted this assumption over the years. But studies show that this assumption is wrong. There's a body of research from the past 15 years concluding that sex offender recidivism rates are lower than what was thought 30 years ago when this was enacted. And while the traditional belief has been that offenders were highly likely to reoffend and remain so their entire lives, the current research suggests that after a certain amount of time living offense-free, sex offenders are no more likely to commit another sex offense than anyone else being released for another crime. The research is strong there. Representative O'Neill mentioned that we don't have a lot of Minnesota research on that. We do have some, but that's another piece that warrants further analysis. And so when we talk about this narrative about who's on the registry and that we need to track these people, the false part is about the recidivism. It's such a small piece of the problem of sexual violence. Many states are actively engaged in reforming their registry because we know more now, and the states are responding. And further, the American Law Institute is currently considering sweeping changes to its model penal code regarding juvenile registration and other aspects of adult registration. There is deep concerns that registries may not be working, that they may be working against public safety by creating a divide between us and them and creating hurdles and obstacles for registrants and their ability to fully integrate into their communities. And I would just end with this comment, is that we all share a vision for safe communities. We all want that. We all want law enforcement to be able to do its very important job and to do it well. And that means effectively and quickly. We share a vision for supporting victims and survivors. And we share a vision in reducing and eliminating sexual violence. But we fulfill this vision by carefully considering, who are we tracking? Why are we tracking them? And what are the impacts to our communities by doing it this way? That's all I have, and I thank you very much for your time. I thank you all in this committee for your service to Minnesota.
Thank you for those remarks, Ms. Bettison, and I hope that you can hang out for a bit in case there's questions for you afterwards. Now we'll turn it over to Ms. Keyes. Are you ready?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Angela Kiza, and I'm an assistant attorney general. I've been with the attorney general's office for 22 years, primarily working in the criminal division, where I have worked on predatory offender registration issues. I will address three of the areas on which the majority of the working group recommended legislative reform: registration requirements for juvenile offenders, amending restart registration periods, and evaluating the mandatory minimums for failure to register offenses. With respect to juvenile offenders, under the current law, they have the same statutory registration requirements as adult offenders, meaning juveniles of any age are required to register if the statute applies. A majority of the working group supported treating juveniles differently than adults. Three potential options were identified and discussed, and really actually maybe a couple more than that, but the three main ones that were identified and discussed, none reached the consensus of the group. The identified options included limiting juvenile registrants by age, type of offense committed, or complete removal of predatory offender registration requirements for juvenile offenders. Another recommendation was regarding the restart of registration periods. Under current law, the 10-year registration period restarts if a registered offender is incarcerated for any new conviction or supervision violation at any time during the registration period. A majority of the working group supported limiting the applicable crimes that would serve as a trigger for the restart of that registration period. For example, by including only felony offenses and more serious gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor offenses. And then another recommendation was regarding the mandatory minimum sentence for failure to register convictions. Current law calls for a mandatory minimum sentence of a year and a day for the first conviction. The court's allowed to deviate from that mandatory minimum only for substantial and compelling reasons. A majority of the working group supported having no mandatory minimums the first time someone fails to register. The mandatory minimum provisions would apply only to second or subsequent failure to register convictions, with the majority recommendation of the group. And those are the three areas that I wanted to update this group on. I thank you for your service. And I will leave it to Sheriff Heck to talk about the remaining recommendations of the working group. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kesey. And I believe I mispronounced your name the first time. Sorry about that.
That's all right. It's common. It's the German pronunciation.
Well, thank you for those comments and that update. Sheriff Heck, please go ahead.
Thank you, Sheriff Frazier, members of the committee. Appreciate your time today and appreciate you looking into this very important issue. My name is Troy Heck. I'm the Benton County Sheriff. I've been the Sheriff of Benton County for the last 7 years, and I have 27 years of experience in law enforcement. I'm here before you today representing two interests. First, as a co-chair of the group, representing the wishes of the group and discussing that with you, and also representing the views of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. And sometimes those two views will run opposed to each other. I wanted to address the POR and what it means to law enforcement. To law enforcement, this is a very important tool for those very critical cases where you have a sexual assault that is out of the ordinary in that you don't know who the suspect is. As has already been mentioned, in the overwhelming majority of cases of sexual assault and predatory offenses, we do know who our suspect is, and we work hard at clearing those. It is especially concerning when we don't know who that suspect is, because we don't have then the means to attempt to stop this future behavior and protect public safety. So to law enforcement, it's very important that we have in this database the right people. We want to have in this database people who have shown by their previous behavior that they have the ability and inclination to, at least at one point in their lives, commit these crimes. By taking what we know about this important crime that we're trying to solve and comparing it to the data points that are in the database, we can get ourselves a starting point. That's not to say that we believe that every predatory offense that has an unknown offender is going to be found in the POR database. But when you are starting from zero, to have this tool to at least begin looking at potential suspects is very important. And over the years, in anecdotal cases, we have seen that this database has played a critical role in solving some of these very important cases. So as I said, to be effective, the database has to have the right people in the data. During discussion about the issue around having the right people in this database, the work group came to the topic of false imprisonment and Minnesota's same set of circumstances law. Just as a brief review, false imprisonment is a crime that happens when someone restrains someone else without authority and keeps them from moving about or doing what they wish. So that is a registration offense for a good reason. A suspect intent upon committing a sexual assault or predatory offense certainly is likely to restrain a victim. However, the issue with this crime comes in the same set of circumstances provision, because false imprisonment can happen in a wide variety of crimes. One particular category of crime that was brought up during the discussion relates to domestic violence. Everybody in the work group and law enforcement agrees domestic violence is a serious issue that needs to be properly addressed. The distinction, I think, comes in when we're talking about the POR. Again, we want to have the right people in there. And so the issue that was identified is that some people who are engaging in domestic violence rightly get charged with false imprisonment. The work group recognized that this group of individuals who are committing a domestic violence likely have a lower nexus to future predatory offenses than the person who's committing false imprisonment for the benefit of facilitating a sexual assault or predatory offense. So the way the law stands now, there are individuals who commit a domestic violence offense, also are charged with a false imprisonment offense, that get caught up in the registry and may not necessarily have that nexus to a future predatory offense. So to remedy this, one of the ideas that was brought about by a majority of the members of the working group was to remove the same set of circumstances attachment to the false imprisonment statute, retaining the false imprisonment requirement of registration after conviction. By doing that, it would allow prosecutors and the courts to assess which type of offender we have. Do we have an offender who has a clear nexus to potential future predatory offenses, or do we have an offender who has a lower likelihood and they could pursue the proper course there? So by, again, removing that same set of circumstances attachment, it provides another level of decision-making, another level of discretion that could potentially accomplish the idea of reducing the number of people that are in the database that don't necessarily benefit law enforcement. The other issue I wanted to speak about today that the working group addressed was the issue of individuals living in alternative housing arrangements. As you're likely aware, currently Minnesota statute requires those without a permanent address to report to their local law enforcement agency on a weekly basis to report with as much accuracy as possible exactly where they're staying. It could be I'm staying at the bench in Hyde Park. It could be I'm staying underneath the bridge on First Avenue. Regardless of where they're staying, they're supposed to report to us where that is so we can find this individual if we need to and have that weekly visit to make sure that they're still there and still compliant. Much has changed in the time since this registration requirement was placed on predatory offenders in the world of technology and in the prevalence of technology, I think especially. You see very frequently that even those who are lacking a primary residence have a cell phone. While the working group didn't craft a specific proposal as far as what this alternative would look like, the working group did find value in exploring the idea of finding ways that individuals who have these alternative housing arrangements, whether it's due to homelessness or whether they're living in a congregate facility or if they're in the hospital or whatever the occasion may be, that they have a way to more conveniently report and remain in compliance in a manner that also provides law enforcement with the assurance that we are talking to the right person and are getting the correct information from them. So that would be the working group's recommendation to explore this idea to see if we can't find a technological answer to solve both the issue of providing more convenience for those on the POR and making sure that law enforcement has the information that we need. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that anyone on the committee has, as I'm sure Stacy and Andrew would as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Sheriff Hack. Members, we will begin to open it up for discussion, and I do want to note that we have Mark Blevin from DOC, Olivia Anderson, and Katie Myers also from BCA that are also available for potential questions. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add a couple things quickly regarding the juvenile cases. So there, when we were talking about this, there were 40 juveniles that were currently on the registry, and that's out of about 18,000. So it's a fairly small number. But what we didn't know, which is why we need the data, is how many started as juveniles on the registry and now as adults are categorized as adults. So that data was not easily obtained. So I think that is a crucial and critical piece of a data point that we need. The other thing I would say that wasn't discussed by the three co-chairs is that an idea came up that, so I'll just back it up just for a sec. So back a few years ago, the legislature extended juvenile stay of adjudication so that they go through sex offender treatment, and it went from 6 months to 12 months. And we saw a precipitous drop in those that actually went onto the registry. It was dealing with it on the front end. It was helpful. It was effective. Many juveniles took advantage of that. But that being said, 12 months is not long enough to finish sex offender treatment in its totality. So there's still an impediment there. And I think it is vital that we look at that very, very closely. If we extend it to 18 months or maybe even 24 months of a stay of adjudication so that that juvenile could complete treatment and actually have some aftercare and make sure that all is good, keeping them off of the registry. I think that could be one of the best things that this legislature could possibly do. We did have some discussions about that. Again, didn't come to an agreement, but I would really hope that the legislature here, that our body would be willing to extend the POR working group so that we could look at that more in depth as well. The last thing I wanted to add is about the homelessness. So that is a huge issue. When Wilder Foundation, as they do every January, they do the homelessness study. This last January, just last month, they found that 8,000 Minnesotans approximately were homeless. And of those, 4,000, half of them had been discharged from the DOC. Now, I don't know how many of those were POR, you know, on the POR. I don't know because we simply don't have that data point. But it illustrates the fact that half of those that are currently homeless or were in January came straight out of our prison system. So we absolutely have to work on that. Again, we need more time to figure out how to make those components work. But those are my pleas to my colleagues, is if we could work, one, extend the POR working group so that we can have more time. Two, we need a better data system. So we need to create a better data system that talks to the courts and it talks to the BCA and all the people that need to know. And that we would really work on this homelessness portion of it with technology, because it's really unfair. It's just wholly unfair to those that are held to that standard. And how in the world do they possibly get to a law enforcement center every single week, the way it's done now? And if they don't do it, then they're on the registry another 10 years. So those are my pleas from being in this working group for months and months and months. We had three meetings in the subcommittee each week. It was a lot of work. So those are my pleas to my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank everybody that worked on this. This is a tough task that you guys took on. 245-page report was a lot. I guess I just want to express, though, I mean, I'm a little disappointed on the juvenile side that we don't have any resolution. So while Representative O'Neill, I hear that you're talking about, you know, there's 40 juveniles that are impacted by this right now, they don't have a petition process. And that's disappointing. As a clinical social worker, I can tell you that adolescent brain at 10 compared to 25 is massively different. I think that we can, I can even tell you what I was like at 10. Definitely not making good decisions though. I was a child. And so I'm glad that you're looking at solutions, disappointed that you don't have something for us this session that we can look at. Even a petition process would have been, that would have been great. You're talking about the stays of adjudication, but those current juveniles have no option. And, you know, I think the one most powerful thing that I received on this was a letter from Patty Wetterling this summer. She sent letters to committee members. And, coming from her, who has, the POR is there because of the immense work of a mother's love. I really do hope that you guys will go back to the table on this. I think young people need to have options. I think that people deserve a petition process. Thank you for your work. Please get something on juveniles next time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Ms. Bettison, I saw you put your hand up. I'm assuming it's to the point that that Representative Edelson was making.
Yeah, very briefly, Representative Edelson, thank you. And we did think about a separate petition process for juveniles, but what we ended up with, in part because we ran out of time, I think, is that petition process that I spoke about would apply to, would be available to juveniles as well.
Thank you. Representative Edelson.
Just really quick to the testifier that just spoke, one of the co-chairs. I'm just curious, I realize that there was no consensus. There was never unanimous agreement. What were some of the issues that were raised about the petition process for juveniles? Why were people opposed to that? Can anybody speak to that?
Yeah, I will let Sheriff Heck speak to that because I was not opposed to it. I was one of the champions of it. So I'll let those who disagree with it speak.
Sheriff Heck.
Thank you. So my main concern is that, first, I would completely agree that juveniles have a different thought process and that certainly the way we think as 10, 12, 13-year-olds is different than the way we think as 25-year-olds. My concern and law enforcement concern is, again, that idea of how do we figure out who are the right people to have on this list? Because certainly there will be a number of juveniles who commit predatory offenses, who go through treatment and who successfully complete that treatment and have no issues. Then there are going to be those who begin their career of predatory offenses as a juvenile and will fail at treatment and will continue their pattern of doing this throughout the life. And our concern is that if we either just eliminate all juveniles or have a process that is far too liberal in removing individuals from the registry, you're going to miss that opportunity to capture that person who, as a juvenile, committed a sex offense and now is going to continue doing that later on into life. So if we can come up with a way that is going to concretely differentiate who these two individuals are, the one that definitely is going to respond to treatment and will not do this again versus the one that is going to be an issue in the future, I think that's a solution that could be workable, but I've not seen that solution proposed yet.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Sheriff. If we kept people without giving them an option to redeem themselves, a 10-year-old we're talking about here, Sheriff, I guess I would just hope that when you guys go back to the table on this, that a petition process would really look at that. And I think, who's going to be looking through that petition process, maybe put in some things that would make law enforcement agreeable to that, but come with some solutions, because it's not okay. I'm not okay with it anyways, but thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many thanks to Representatives Mueller and O'Neill and everybody who worked on this. It's incredibly important. And I guess I'll just want to build on Representative Edelson's point to just say that we have a system right now that I think is not working well. And again, I'm so grateful to those who've been putting their time in to make things work better. And I know that there's a lot more that needs to happen. I want to both make a quick comment and just ask a question. The comment is just building on what Sheriff Heck talked about false imprisonment. So I'm a prosecutor in Ramsey County, specialized in domestic violence for a long time. And I'll just say the situation with false imprisonment in particular, I've been enormously frustrated with through the years. And I really am grateful to you all for focusing on it. And I want to make sure we just have in our minds that in my experience anyway, it's actually pretty rare that we have sexual intent involved in that crime, at least not without some other crime being chargeable. The classic example for me is a boyfriend who maybe blocks the girlfriend from leaving a bedroom because he's insisting they talk and won't let her out. Now, that is a felony. That is false imprisonment. I am great charging that. On the other hand, there's not something sexual that's happening there. If I charge that right now, it does not matter how that case is resolved. If there's any conviction in the lease for any crime, that person is a predatory offender, and we are spending a lot of time and money tracking that person and a lot of problems. So I'm really grateful to you all for working on that piece in particular, because it's one that's really bothered me as a DD prosecutor. And then, Sheriff, my question for you, I think in particular, maybe for others, is it seems to me that the registry at this point really does lack much value in connecting suspects with crimes. In particular, I'm thinking about the advances in DNA evidence and the fact that presumably most of the people on the registry, their DNA is in the system. And so I guess I'm just wondering about the value given DNA especially, and other things as well, but that especially is on my mind. Can you just comment on that?
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. So yes, DNA is a wonderful advancement. When I give talks about what we do and talk about sexual assault, I mention that DNA are my three favorite letters in the world. But not every case has DNA. The predatory offender database has a wealth of information about these folks in there, from where they live, to the cars they drive, to the jobs they work, to a whole lot of data points that we collect on these folks. And when we have an unknown suspect and we're trying to match up parts of what we know about this crime with who our suspect might be, this database provides a wealth of information. We could search, if we know what the car is, we could search for that car in the database. And again, this database is not going to be the end all be all of who we are going to look at to try to figure out who this committed this crime. But the more of these factors that we know that we can match up against folks who we also know have committed these crimes in the past, it gives us a place to start to begin either including or eliminating folks from future consideration.
Quick follow, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. And so, Sheriff, I will say I'm in a charging position now in the county, and so I receive a wide variety of cases coming in. I'm obviously not part of the investigation, but I see a lot of investigations. I have to admit, I can't think of an example like those that you cite. Doesn't mean they're not out there, but I guess I'm just wondering, can you think, not that you need to get into it, but is there a concrete case that you can think of in recent memory in the last, year? Let's say, because of course we're putting a lot of time and money, and I should say a lot of civil liberties implications on people. I'm just wondering, is there a specific case that you can think of in your mind where you say, hey, you know what, that really did make the difference?
So I think that your point is well taken.
Perfect.
And forgive me. Thank you, Sheriff Frazier. Your point is well taken in that these are extraordinarily rare cases. However, you look back to the cases of Drew Shodin and Katie Poyer and the role that the registry played in those. And then you look at what is the value you put on solving that one case where we had an unknown offender, that it would have gone unsolved, but for the fact that we could have this registry where we could dip into and look for people that had aspects of their person or aspects of their life that matched things we knew about this case. I completely agree. This is not going to be something that we're using to solve 100 cases a year. We might not even solve 5 cases a year using the POR. But when you talk about someone who's been a victim of a predatory offense or a sexual assault, to have this tool available, I don't know how you put a value on.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Sheriff Hack. Members, I'm going to ask that we be brief. I plan to move on at 11:20 sharp. We have a few other bills that I want to make sure that we get to today. Representative Grosso.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Oh, sorry, Representative O'Neill.
Can we just have the BCA, who had testified to this in these these working groups, answer that question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Who would like from BCA? We have Olivia Anderson or Katie Myers.
Yes. Hello, my name is Olivia Anderson. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Through the working group, one of our agents, Josh Florell, shared that he uses the registry every day.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask for what?
Representative Pinto.
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask for what does he use it? If she knows.
Ms. Anderson.
Chair Frazier, Representative Pinto, I would have to ask Josh to clarify, and we're happy to provide additional data. Unfortunately, I am not an agent, and therefore I do not participate in the investigative end.
If we could, Mr. Chair, that'd be great to just get that sent. If we could just have that sent to us afterwards, that'd be great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Anderson. President O'Neill, is it till this point?
Yes. Just very quickly, so what Josh had said more than one time, probably 3, 4, 5 times, is that he uses the registry every single day in the process of solving crimes, because the BCA is the liaison between law enforcement. So they run all of the data, they test all the DNA and the touch, and, you know, so they're sending their investigatory pieces to the BCA, and Josh is saying he uses it every single day to solve crimes. That's what he said.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would somebody, any of the testifiers, please, could you list for the committee, what are the offenses, what are the crimes that put you on the predatory offender registry? Maybe if Rep. Mohler or one of the other people from the BCA could answer that, please.
President Mohler.
Thank you, sir. I actually defer to one of my experts, probably Ms. Kisa. Would you be able to answer that question?
Ms. Kisa.
So there's a whole list in the statute, so I would have to get back to you if you want the exact list, but we did include those as attachments to the report. There's not only, there's kind of a handy list that the BCA uses that lists them all out with the statutory numbers and the description of the offense. And then I think there's the statute itself is included in the report too.
I'll give you the short list that I have. These are people that have committed murders. These are people that have committed kidnapping, people that have committed sexual assault, people that have committed child pornography offenses. There's a whole list of things, and these are they have to meet that criteria to be put on the predatory offender registry. So it is something that needs to be looked at. Yes, there could be things that are fixed on it. Yes, but you must do that cautiously and I know the group will do that. They'll look at it and make those assessments, because this is an important tool. And to Representative Pinto's question, a recent case where being on the predatory offender registry would have made a difference in a case in Beltrami County, Jacob Kinn. Jacob Kinn did county time for possession of child pornography. He was also producing it, but the prosecutor at that time settled on the possession conviction. Jacob Kinn did not have to register when he came out, because he did county time. He did not come out of the state prison system where he would have been assessed a level. And so when he murdered his girlfriend, abducted a 6-year-old girl and raped her in a rural part of Minnesota, had he been on the registry during the initial start of that investigation,
where they could, where they looked at who are the predatory offenders in this area, he would have come up on the radar a lot sooner. So the predatory offender registry is very important for law enforcement to be able to get on these cases, get moving as fast as they can, because, you know, would it have prevented him from sexually assaulting that child? I don't know. That was what his mission was that day, to take that child.
Thank you, Representative Grasso. So can we?
That's just an example of how important this predatory offender registry is for law enforcement to help people.
Thank you, Representative Grasso. Representative Mola, was it to this point?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair, and I'll be very brief. I believe child pornography is a registrable offense, so I'm a little confused by that example, but I think sometimes people confuse registry with the leveling, the levels that people are assessed. Representative Grasso mentioned levels, and so I don't know if that's what he was talking about instead, but I just was a little bit of confusion around that example.
Thank you, Representative Mulder. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to kind of just briefly touch on the point that Representative Edelson mentioned earlier about juveniles. And I'm concerned about the juveniles in this case and their right to petition. And I would just like to say, if the age of consent in Minnesota is 16 or 18, if I have that correct, based on the involvement of the parties, for those, especially those who are not of an age of consent, I would like for us to think about how we could maybe allow space for them to petition or how they're considered on this registry if they're not old enough to give consent. I think that says something about their brain development also. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, members, and thank you, testifiers, and thank you all that are part of the work group. I know this is tough work, not easy work, but it's work that needs to be done, and I'm sure we're going to have more conversation about this as we move forward, and we have to push on now to our next item agenda, which is, Representative Mola, I believe you're going to stay with us a little bit longer. Representative Mola brings House File 2770, Sodomy, Fornication, and Adultery Crimes Repealed. Representative Mueller, is your motion, I'm going to need someone to make a motion to refer House File 2770 to the General Register. Representative Claiborne, would you mind making that motion?
I move I'm so moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. The motion to refer House File 2770 to the General Register made on behalf of Representative Claiborne. Representative Mueller, your House File 2770 is now in front of us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one should be a much quicker conversation than our last discussion, which was really helpful. Thank you. So members, this bill repeals the discriminatory and outdated crimes of sodomy, fornication, and adultery from our books. You've supported this bill before. Last year, it was also part of the Criminal Sexual Conduct Working Group's recommendations. It was part of our reform bill. And the working group described these statutes as, quote, archaic and unconstitutional, close quote. The working group report, again, is included in your packet. Again, we passed this last year. Unfortunately, the other body removed the repealer language when they agreed to the other recommendations. And so that's why I'm introducing this repealer as a standalone bill this year. And Mr. Chair, I have one testifier on this today.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Your testifier is this Ms. Granda?
That's correct.
Ms. Granda, please proceed.
Hi, thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee, for allowing me this time. So to speak to what Representative Mueller just said, the statutes, we call them archaic. We saw that there was a desperate need for us to change those. We're really at the forefront of so much amazing change when it comes to sexual assault, the prevention of sexual assault, removing some of the language that was previously in. We did that with our Criminal Sexual Conduct Working Group. I was part of the original steering committee for that group and actually was helped with the creation of it. So following it through, this was also something we had talked about, but as Representative Mueller said, something that didn't go through last year fully. So I definitely want to say that as a victim survivor, as a member of the steering committee, as an advocate, I feel like it's really important that we take a look at this. I'm also going to just quickly, I would like to just quickly say a quick story to this, and I will be very brief. But it's a story that comes back to me a lot and gives me a lot of hope. There was once a wise teacher who was preaching in a temple when a group of scribes and Pharisees confronted him. They brought in a woman who accusing her of committing adultery, claiming that they caught her in the act. They tell the teacher that the punishment for someone like her should be stoning, as prescribed under the Mosaic law. The teacher begins to write something on the ground with his finger as the women's accusers continue their challenge. The teacher responds by saying, "The one who is without sin should be the first one to cast the first stone at her." The accusers and congregants departed, realizing that not one of them was without sin. We as a group, I feel, and as our society and our culture and in our state, cannot throw stones. We are no longer under Mosaic law. We have the grace of God, and we have an opportunity to change this. And I know many of you were already on board with that, but I feel like I needed to share that because it's something that gives me hope right now. So thank you so very, very much.
Ms. Granda, thank you for that. I failed to do this at the beginning, but could you please state your name for the record?
I completely forgot. Kila Marie Granda.
Thank you, Ms. Granda. Members will now open it up for discussion. I am not seeing any hands for discussion. Representative Mulder, do you have any closing thoughts on this?
I don't, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your support, members.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Mulder. The chair will be laying this bill over for further consideration to be included with the omnibus bill. Do we need to take a vote on this?
Mr. Chair, I think the motion was to refer it to the general register from Representative Cleburne.
So we will need to take a vote.
You're looking at my notes. Check it with staff just a second. Now we're going to, in my notes, I'm on an agenda here. We have it that we're going to lay this over.
So, Chair, then you need to change the motion.
The motion that I made was for the general register.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
I was just going to say, I don't think the motion needs to be changed. I think that actually would be a proper motion regardless, just that then you as the chair simply lay the bill over and we don't have a vote on the motion. So yeah, just in terms of procedure, I don't think the motion would need to be changed. However, that looks like there may be some question as to whether where you intend to have the bill go, but I don't think the motion needs to be changed either way.
Hold on a sec. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can't have a motion to send it to the general register and then lay it over. That would not be in order. You'd either have to withdraw the motion to send it on to the general register, or another motion could be made to table it, which would supersede the motion to send it to the general register.
Chair Frazier.
Representative Claiborne.
It was my understanding that we were going to send this bill to the general register, which does not preclude it from also being included in the committee bill. So it is, that's an and, but if we are going to, as Representative Lucero said, only include it in our bill, then we need to change the motion.
I'd say Chair's gonna make a decision here. Let's vote to send it to the general register. Please take the roll call.
Chair Mariani, absent. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleburne?
Cleburne, aye.
Representative Cleburne, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
Lucero, no.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny, absent. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye. Yeah, absolutely.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Shung.
Aye.
Representative Shung.
Aye.
With 15 ayes, 2 nays, and 2 absent, that concludes the roll.
For 15 ayes, 2 nays, and 2 absent, House File 2770 will be referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Mohler. Next up is House File 2815, brought by Representative Miller. Representative Miller, thank you, and welcome to the committee. This is surreptitious intrusion cases, statute of limitations amended. I will make the motion to move to refer to House File 2815 to the General Register, but I do have a note to make. There was an author's amendment that was filed on time. However, we were late to get it posted. So I'll take the bag for that as the chair for today. We would like to get that posted, but I would like Representative Miller to explain what the amendment is, and we will land this bill over for consideration, and we will include that amendment if we include it in the bill at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to clarify your motion. You made a motion to move it to the General Register. This is actually to lay it over for possible inclusion. I don't want to tell you what to do with your committee.
No, you're right. I'm looking at my notes here. I got some confusion with the notes. The motion is to lay it over. Representative Miller, to the amendment that I'd like you to discuss your amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you're doing fine. They threw you into the fire early and hot, so I think it's all okay. And I do appreciate the time that the committee me this, Mr. Chair. And to the amendment, after we showed this bill to the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, they felt that the starting point for what my bill is addressing on the statute of limitations, it's more clarified for them if we give when the amendment just simply says after the offense was reported to law enforcement authorities. I talked to a handful of people, and they all agreed that that was probably a clear way to state that. And I do take responsibility for that. I apologize, members. It's my bill. It's my responsibility to make sure things come to committee in the proper way. So I thank you for your grace on that amendment. I understand that will be put in if it's included in an omnibus bill. That amendment to clarify that starting date will be put in at that time. So, members, I'm going to be very brief. I appreciate the time that we've taken on these other issues, and I don't want to take up the time of my testifiers, but I do ask that you listen to my testifiers. They are the ones that have come forward. They've shown a lot of courage in their willingness to speak on sort of a disgusting issue. But we have a problem. As our technology moves forward, we're going to be hearing more bills like this, members, and all this really does is it doesn't extend a statute of limitations. It just changes when the statute of limitations starts. And I think this is something that the legislature is going to have to wrestle with on a lot of different ways. Some people will say that this issue that my testifiers are going to talk about is not a big deal, like this was just a simple offense. But when you hear what happened is there were 16 total victims on what occurred here. And only 6 of them can be prosecuted because of a technical issue that my bill hopes to address. So I'm going to move, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'm going to introduce and then you can get them going. But I'm going to introduce both of my testifiers. I'm not sure which one is going first. You can decide that, or I guess they can if you leave it up to them.
That's fine. There's Elisa. Go ahead.
Her name, proper name is Elisa Steinslin. I was worried about saying her first name right now. I think I just said her last name wrong. And then Madeline Pong. If you could introduce them and let them tell their story as to what this bill is about.
Ms. Pong, if you'd like to go and state your name for the record and then proceed.
Yes, absolutely. Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Madeline Pong, and I am before you today on Zoom to share my story and shed light on the importance of amending the statute of limitations for invasion of privacy crimes in the state of Minnesota under Bill HF 2815. Unbeknownst to me, my personal story of victimization and exploitation occurred on April 22nd, 2018. On that date, nearly 4 years ago, I accepted an offer from a childhood friend to tour his pig farm in Olivia, Minnesota. I viewed this as a novelty experience. When we arrived at the farm, he told me that I had to shower because of biohazard requirements. Hog barns are biohazard controlled, meaning
Representative Johnson, could you please, thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Pong, sorry.
No worries. When we arrived at the farm, he told me that I had to shower because of biohazard requirements. Hog barns are biohazard controlled, meaning by law, one must shower in and shower out to prevent contamination and illness. I did as told and never thought, and continued with the tour and never having thought about it again until May 3rd, 2021. This was the date that my sense of security was ripped away from me and the definition of betrayal took a new meaning. On this day, an article published by the West Central Tribune was sent to me. The link was titled, Olivia Mann Alleged to Have Filmed Women in the Shower at His Hog Barn. I read the article multiple times just to make sure I was understanding it correctly. 23 videos and 104 still images were surreptitiously taken of naked women showering in his hog barn without their knowledge or consent between October 30th, 2016 and December 12th, 2019. I felt physically ill and emotionally traumatized because I knew at that moment I was the victim of a sexually motivated crime. I had no idea of the emotional roller coaster path that lay before me, nor did I understand the gravity and impact it would have on my mental health. I would become known as victim number 10 of 16 female victims to the Renville County Sheriff's Office. After reading the article, I immediately contacted the Sheriff's Department and within a day was connected to Detective Jeff Nelson, the lead investigator on the case. After confirming my identity in one of the videos, he explained that the perpetrator used the same method of operation in committing every one of his crimes. He waited until each victim were showering off, wherein he simultaneously snuck outside, climbed up a ladder, watched and filmed me and 15 other women naked through an egress-style window. He also informed me in that same conversation that although I was a victim, my case would not be included in charges brought against the perpetrator under Minnesota State Statute 609.746 Subdivision 1D. Only 6 out of the 16 victims in this case were protected and considered chargeable offenses due to the 3-year statute of limitations for invasion of privacy. This same statute failed me and slammed its door in my face before I even knew that I was a victim. The painful truth in my particular case is that I missed the deadline by 8 calendar days. Just as painful is the realization that 9 additional victims were left to deal with the ongoing consequences of his actions and without their day in court, all due to the inadequate statute of limitations for invasion of privacy. Now, while a life wasn't lost, something intangible yet profoundly valuable had been. My sense of security and trust have been irreparably shattered, and my grief is further compounded by the fact that receiving justice for my case and those that occurred before mine is impossible. Holding my perpetrator accountable in criminal court for the crimes he committed against me and others is not an option, an opportunity that the law is supposed to afford me. It has forced me to rethink what justice looks like and compelled me to pay attention to where the law falls short. Mr. Chair, there's a major flaw in the law we are re-examining today. I want to be very explicit. The statute of limitations for invasion of privacy expires before many victims even know they are victims of a crime, thereby perpetuating re-victimization. I reject the concept of criminals not being held accountable for the crimes they commit because they were able to go undetected long enough for a time clock to run out. It's egregious that any crime associated with sexual exploitation has a deadline to file charges, while the trauma the victims experience has no expiration date. It is imperative that we amend Bill HF 2815 to reflect a more equitable and reasonable window for the victims of crimes to seek justice and have a seat at the prosecution table. The victims of invasion of privacy crimes deserve a voice beyond the current statute of limitations 3-year limit. I implore you to approve the revisions of Amendment 628.26 Limitations Section 1J proposed by Representative Miller today that allow indictments to be found, made, and filed within 3 years after the discovery of any photograph or recording obtained in violation of Section 609.746 Subdivision 1. It is worthy of your consideration and vote. This amendment will have a positive impact on countless victims and negate the emotional distress that occurs when victims perceive the door has been closed on them. Thank you, Representative Miller, for your due diligence in offering and submitting this amendment. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee for your time and consideration.
Ms. Pong, thank you for the testimony. I know it can't be easy to continue to recount that story, but thank you for sharing it with us today. Ms. Steinslin, please state your name and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for taking the time to hear our stories, and thank you to Representative Miller for submitting this bill. My name is Elisa Steinsland, and I am before you today urging you to support Bill HF2815, extending the statute of limitations starting at discovery. The crime I'm a victim of took place in 2017, but for me, my story doesn't start until April 2021. My fiancé was an officer in the Navy, just came home from being underway at a sub. We were close friends with my perpetrator. When we first heard the claims that he was filming women unclothed at his hard barn, we gave our close friend the benefit of the doubt. It wasn't until one of his best friends confirmed she was a victim that we realized it was truly happening. The whole time I was panicking, knowing very well I'd been at that hog barn years ago. I received a phone call from a local detective saying that he had a video of me unclothed in the shower. He also told me with pain in his voice there was nothing he could do for me, not having the law on our side. Because my video was taken 4 years ago, it fell outside the statute of limitations for interference of privacy. And before I even knew about the crime, the time was up for me to file charges. In one phone call, I lost so much. I lost my feeling of safety, I lost a friend, and I lost trust. Trust in people, but also the law, who did not have room for me in my story. Let me take you back to August 2017. I had been invited to go visit my former friend's hog barn. I agreed, wanting to support my friend. He picked me up and explained why I had to shower, to protect his pigs from the disease. He mentioned that he didn't have a shower curtain, but the window was too high up for someone to look through. Trusting my friend, I wasn't worried about it. What I didn't know was that he carried a ladder to the window, filmed me on his phone, violating me without my knowledge. Afterwards, we hung out at his house. Not even once did I think my friend could do something like that to me. The fact that this happened 4 years ago didn't make it less painful. It made it worse. In this time, I've had dinners with my perpetrator. I was invited to his wedding. He was invited to my wedding. I talked to him, I looked him in the eyes, and I trusted him. Who knows what has been done with the videos and pictures in those 4 years? I have no clue what those pictures were used for. The fact that I didn't know also meant that I couldn't prevent this from happening to other women. All 16 victims found out at the same time, but for 10 of us, the time to press charges had passed. We didn't stand a chance and lost a race before we even knew it had started. As victims, you're often told to don't let people make you a victim and fight back. The law in place today deprived 10 of us from that option, making it feel like we had less value than the other six, just because of the timing of our crime. I know some of the other victims are watching today because this bill means so much to each one of us. My perpetrator took so much from me, and I felt like I had no power to take anything back. I can't even imagine if none of us could have pressed charges, meeting my perpetrator in the grocery store, living his life as if nothing happened. Growing up in Norway, I always watched American movies, amazed by the effort law enforcement put into solve crime. Our lawyers, judges, and politicians fight for justice, and I've always felt protected by the law here. I understand that when this law was written, it was with good intentions, dating back to a time when criminal cases relied heavily on eyewitnesses or reliable technology. Today, with the advancement of technology, we have access to more reliable evidence, but it also opens up the possibility of victims not being aware of crimes committed. I fully support this bill, and I hope you will too, because this bill is a crucial first step, but I don't think it should be the last. Time is a critical consideration, but by no means is it the only one. How we define this crime also matters. Not only was I told that my case was too old to bear any legal weight, which was funny to me since to me it had just happened, I was also told that it was just a gross misdemeanor called interference of privacy, same as if he had looked through my window at my property. The law seemed to not recognize that this was a sex crime or a sexual offense. By using words that do not accurately describe the crime, we diminish the crime itself. This is then reflected in the communities we live in. Victims have overheard people shrug it off like it's not a big deal. Many people still think there are only six victims because that's what's in the criminal case. This is a crime that doesn't only affect the victims, but our families and an entire town. Receiving justice for the victim is a huge part of the healing process for a community to come together. I urge you to consider how we define crimes like this and to send a message that preying on women, young women, and exploiting their bodies are completely unacceptable no matter the form it takes. Being told that a man filmed 16 of his closest friends, family friends, and his best friend's girlfriends naked 24 times took 104 still pictures, and saying that there's nothing sexual to this felt like an insult. When I started therapy, I was asked, have you ever been sexually assaulted? According to the law, I have not. But after I told my therapist what had happened to me, she said, that is sexual assault. And it was the first time my experience felt validated. Sexually motivated crimes are sex crimes. I therefore urge you to not only pass this bill, but also look into how cases like this can be treated as a sex crime. To give agency to future victims, to allow communities to heal, and considering the advancement of technology, I urge you to support this bill. Fighting for justice is not a small task, and victims often risk facing scrutiny themselves. But this is something we would have done if the law would have let us, not only for ourselves, but for all the victims we unfortunately know will come after. I wish I had had a bill that is now being proposed, and I hope that any victim after me will be protected by this change of law. Times change, and so must the law. Thank you for your time.
Thank you as well, Ms. Nisley, for sharing that story. I know it can't be easy, but thank you for sharing it with us. Members, I will now open it up for discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much to the victims to sharing your story today. I myself, as a victim, also could not prosecute the perpetrator that offended me, but I was able to pursue a civil action which had some damage. But I'm curious to the author, are these victims, are they able to pursue a civil action, or somebody that maybe we could ask on the call here?
Representative Miller.
He's muted.
Take that off mute, sorry about that, Mr. Chair. Representative Hewitt, that's a good question. We're being sensitive to cases that are ongoing on the civil side, so I'm not going to address that. They do have avenues. I'm not going to go into the detail of what those are. This is a good thing to point out, one point I wanted to make. These women coming forward, as crazy as this may sound, their biggest concern is that they put their cases at risk by even speaking out. And I certainly hope that doesn't happen.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I totally hear that, but it's so important. It was so important for me to tell my story in public and get it out. And I know that this is one of the steps they're taking because it helps them move on. So thank you. This is real hard. This is the first step. I've been there. But, you know, there's a lot of us fighting for you. So thanks for testifying today.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Miller, for bringing this bill into the testifiers. You're so brave to be here and for speaking up. I can't imagine that was easy. I guess, Representative Miller, and I don't know if this would be a better question for Mr. Johnson or Mr. Diebold. I'm curious, I know that this is taking effect in August of 2022, and I'm not sure what your amendment is, but is there, I realize going retroactive is incredibly challenging in cases like this. Have you looked at that? Is that a possibility that you've explored?
Representative Miller.
Representative Edelson, Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, That's a great question. That's something that I wanted to do. My understanding is that's problematic. I will to the House staff, they can answer it. I do know that the assistant county attorney did jump on late to this, and I know we're tight on time, Mr. Chair, but she might be able to directly answer this. She'd need to introduce herself, and I would encourage her to be very brief, but she might be able to answer this most directly.
Who do we have on?
Kelsey Kingstrom, Assistant Rendell County Attorney.
Thank you, Ms. Kingstrom. Go ahead.
Thank you, representatives and chair. It's actually my first time in front of on a bill like this, but I do know as far as retroactivity is entirely an absolutely huge issue, and the statute itself has to include that. Generally speaking, retroactivity is not something that's included. You have a new bill and you can't go back in time. So for example, if murder wasn't a thing now, it can't be a murder. You can't charge murder now in the future, right? But if the statute specifically includes it or case law does, then you can.
Thank you, Ms. Kingstrom. Representative Edelson, any follow-up on it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller, maybe just something to explore. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. And Ms. Kingston just testified on something that I really wanted to focus on specifically. I'm glad she's here. if we look at the new language in 215, it says, and I'm going to go down to line 217, the offense or 3 years after the discovery of any photograph or recording obtained. My question is to the author and potentially to the other testifier, is the word photograph inclusive enough? Should we maybe change that word from photograph to image or image and other transmittable material? And I've got two other follow-ups to this, Mr. Chair, and you'll see where I'm building this.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rowley, what I'm going, this I may rely on House staff, because when we had this problem, I went to nonpartisan House research and said, here's the problem, here's the law, what do we need to do to fix it? And I have a great deal of confidence in House research that they would write this and what's appropriate. A lot of times they look at what existing law is and things like that. I do believe that this is fully inclusive. And I know you have a follow-up question to that, but that's why this bill is written. If there are issues to address to this, I would defer to House research on that.
Mr. Johnson? Or Mr. Debo?
It's me.
All right.
Chair members, the amendment has eliminated all of the language that Representative Rowley just mentioned. So to be clear, there's no longer a reference to photographs and other items. It's now just 3 years after the offense was reported to law enforcement authorities. So that's not a direct answer to the question, but I think it does answer the issue. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Rowley.
Thank you, Chair. So the question that I got is, if an image has been created from another source, such as a still image from a previously submitted or previously discovered video, is that image or other derivative work considered new underneath this new law?
Representative Rowley, is that question to Mr. Johnson or to the author?
Chair, the discretion of the chair. I'm not sure who can answer that one.
That sounds like a question maybe for Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rowley, just to be clear, that language is no longer part of this particular bill. So to be clear, there's no longer going to be any reference to photograph. That's the amendment. The amendment removes all of that language and replaces any reference to the photograph or other sort of image with 3 years after the offense was reported to law enforcement authorities. So the question of whether a new image would be a new occasion would be moot. If that amendment was not adopted, then the language that's in the bill without the amendment says 3 years after the discovery of any photograph. So if it was a single photograph, the first photograph discovered would likely be the triggering event. But again, that language is no longer part of the bill with the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Rowley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly where I wanted to go with this, is I am looking at the future and the changes in technology. Specifically to the author, Representative Miller, what I'm concerned about is deepfakes and derivative utilization of images that are currently contained in either a case or they've been submitted that later are utilized in a derivative or a deepfake type of an environment, specifically along the lines of what we've seen with some celebrities utilizing pornographic images and a superimposed face on them. And I want to make sure, Representative Miller, that we're looking at the future technologies, and if a derivative of a previously captured piece of photography or video or anything else, that this law will take into account that derivative. And so I'm not sure, I've heard that there's the amendment that would solve this, and I want to make sure that we're solving it, because part of our job is to think into the future. And that's what I'm trying to think of, is the derivatives for deepfakes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Rowley, I do appreciate your intent, and I do appreciate the interest in this. That's in part why we adjusted it with the amendment that will be put in, as if this is written in under an omnibus bill. But members, I was on this committee for 2 years, and sometimes we go down rabbit holes. I want to be respectful of everyone's interest in this. but you just heard compelling testimony from two people who want to have justice. They could not get justice. This bill, with its amendment, will provide that justice, as House Research, as the county attorneys, as these people have said. I would love to go to Representative Edelson's. I would love to go retroactively. And if there's a way we can do that, I will do it today. But I have been told that that is very problematic at the least. And so I didn't want to ruin this bill in order to try and pursue that. So members, I implore you that you listen to that testimony of those two very brave young women, and that you can support this bill to move forward.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Members, we do need to push forward. So the chair will renew the motion to lay House File 2815 over for consideration. Representative Miller, thank you for bringing this bill. Seems like it is an important bill. Testifiers, thank you again for sharing your stories. They were very important stories, and we did hear you. Thank you, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Mariani, I see that you're back. Would you like to retake the reins? You're muted.
Only if you're tired, Representative Frazier.
I'm not tired, so I can keep going. But if you want to go ahead.
No, I'm going to watch you for a while. I might do an assessment.
All right.
But I'm here for the remainder of the hearing.
All right. Very good, Chair. Next on the agenda is House File 1306, a bill by Representative Elkins. Metropolitan Council authorized to issue administrative citations for transit fare evasion and impose civil fines, technical and clarifying changes made, and report required. Motion to refer House File 1306 to the General Register. Chair will make the motion. Representative Elkins, are you here?
Mr. Chair, I am here.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Just one note, pursuant to House Rule 420, House File 1306 was returned to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. The committee will not take additional testimony on this bill, as they received the full hearing last year. The committee will vote to re-refer this bill back to the General Register as a procedural matter. Representative Elkins, is there anything you'd like to add before we take the vote?
Not unless there are questions, no.
Seeing Representative Johnson.
Chair Frazier, I see we're, as you mentioned, going back to the General Register. I want to bring up what I brought again last year with this bill. This bill does need to go to Ways and Means, although what's interesting is the fiscal note this year says zero, although I believe there is cost, because I believe there's also new employees. But the bill previous biennium, which is very similar, had a over $6 million fiscal note. I'm not sure what the change was, why they went from over $6 million to zero. Looking at the fiscal note from this year, it doesn't look like the courts were even contacted. So I believe there is some cost, and I do believe this bill does need to go to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. We did speak with Representative Elkins. We reviewed the fiscal note, and we have decided to defer the fiscal note with respect to the question of whether this bill will have a fiscal impact, and therefore warrant a Ways and Means referral. As a result, we will be referring this bill back to the floor. Well, thank you, Representative Johnson. Clerk, please take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleburne?
Aye.
Representative Cleburne, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny, excused. Representative O'Neill?
No.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Shung?
Aye.
Representative Shung, aye. And that concludes roll call with 11 ayes, 7 nays, and 1 excused.
With 11 ayes, 7 nays, and 1 excused, Representative Elkins, you are on your way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is House File 2433, which is by Chair Mariani, public safety entities required to prioritize public safety and human rights. I will make the motion to refer House File 2433 to the General Register. As before, this bill has been heard and included in the omnibus bill last year. The committee will not take additional testimony on this bill as it received the full hearing last year. The committee will vote to re-refer this bill back to the General Register as a procedural matter. Mr. Chair, do you have any comments before we take the vote?
Mr. Chair, only I appreciate the committee's support again as we had it last year.
Just a second. Checking with staff for a second.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is there's sort of a technical issue that might arise given the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm seeing that here. Yeah, we're going to hold off on voting on this because of a technical issue. So we'll hold off, and I guess we'll say, members, thank you for your time today, and we are adjourned.